Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. A number of eyebrows were raised by the decision last week to award this year's Nobel Peace Prize to the European Union. Some people think of the EU as defined by its common currency, the euro, as much as anything else. But there is more complexity and history to the European Union than maybe is immediately evident. So on today's show, we are going to explore what was behind the decision to award the EU the Nobel Peace Prize. We'll also talk a little bit about the history of the European Union, and we'll discuss some of the challenges facing the EU today and in the future, including the fate of the euro and the viability of economically struggling nations within the EU, most notably Greece, where workers walked off the job today for the second time in 3 weeks amid a wave of wage and pension cuts and 5 years of recession. We have a couple of guests with us throughout this hour. Dr. Stefanos Katsikas is Director of Modern Greek Studies at the University of Illinois. He is also interested in cold and post-Cold War European history among his research interests, and he's the author of Negotiating Diplomacy in the New Europe. Dr. Katsikas, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much, and it's my pleasure being with you this morning, and thank you for inviting me.
Glad to have you with us. Also with us is John McCormick, who appeared on this program back in June to discuss the economic crisis in the EU. He's a professor of European Union politics and director of graduate studies in the Department of Political Science at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He's also written a number of books about the European Union. Professor McCormick, welcome back to Focus.
Good to be back.
Glad to have you with us. And later in the hour, we are hoping to be joined by João Vale de Almeida, the European Union ambassador to the United States, though he is traveling this morning, so he may or may not be able to talk with us. We'll see what happens as the hour goes along. We also hope that you will join in our conversation. You can do so by calling 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on our Facebook page, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Professor McCormick, as I mentioned, I think for some people, the European Union is seen, at least these days, as largely an economic partnership and one that is, in that context, struggling. But the EU has a much longer history than its common currency, the euro. Can you sort of walk us through how the European Union began and its initial purpose?
Well, its initial purpose was peace in Europe. It just happened to have achieved it in large part initially by economic integration. People were talking about integration or European cooperation even before World War II, in fact, going back to the Middle Ages. If you look at the history of Europe, you'll know that up until World War II, there was very rarely a time when one European group wasn't at war with another European group. I mean, 100-year war and 80-year war and so on. So at the end of World War II, everybody said, okay, well, this is very expensive and tragic, and we really need to do something about this. So one of the options was economic integration. So they started very simply in 1952 with a thing called the European Coal and Steel Community, which is an experiment to bring together cooperation on the management of coal and steel, and only six countries actually joined that. Then it became the European Economic Community in 1958, which focused on building a single market or a common market, and then since then it's expanded quite substantially. It's now the European Union. It has 27 members. Croatia will be joining next year, so it'll be the 28th member. And it's really gone quite a long way beyond economics, and it's moved into all kinds of different policy areas: foreign policy, environmental policy, immigration, justice and home affairs. There are some areas it doesn't deal with, for example, tax policy and education policy, but it's more than an economic union now, certainly.
Dr. Katsikas, what role did the European Union play in terms of diplomacy and seeking peace during the Cold War? Was it the idea of diplomacy through economic development?
Yes, I would say that its role was very constructive, and it was trying to promote peace and stability in Europe. I mean, we shouldn't forget that Eastern Europe was divided during the Cold War period between Western Europe and Eastern Europe, and one of the largest countries of Europe, Germany, was also divided between West Germany and East Germany. So with the competition between two superpowers and two different military blocs right outside the door of Europe, Europe was eager and willing to promote peace in its neighborhood, and it worked towards peace and stability in Europe, yes.
So how do you develop a union of nations that still remain sovereign nations, that still have their own independent policies, their own independent approaches to a variety of issues, and have it work?
It's an unprecedented political project, I have to say, what we experience in Europe nowadays. I mean, the nation-state started, as Professor McCormick said, after the Second World War, to develop a political, to develop a union which would eventually bring internal peace and stability in the continent. So they decided to abandon part of their sovereignties and come together into forming a union. Now, this process is taking a lot of time, and it's a long-term process, and it's going through various stages. Now we're at a critical moment right now in Europe with this economic crisis, because we have what we have in place is an economic community. We have a monetary union, but what is lacking is a political union. And I think, despite the failings of the, despite the weaknesses of the system that the current economic crisis has brought to the fore and has shown to the rest of the world, I think it's a good opportunity for Europe now to move towards a closer political union. I'm not sure if we're going to experience in the next couple of years what Winston Churchill in 1946 imagined as the United States of Europe, but definitely if Europe wants to overcome the current economic crisis, it has to move towards a closer political cooperation, because the alternative will be going back to the period of economic protectionism, economic competition, rise of ultra-nationalist parties, xenophobia, and possibly, in the long term, another war. I mean, history is moving forward, but it can move backwards as well. So there is, in my view, there is no alternative for Europe but to move forward and to move towards a closer political cooperation.
Professor McCormick, do you feel that this is why the European Union ultimately was given the Nobel Peace Prize this year? This idea of this union is really what would offset the potential for a future war within Europe?
I think I'm very happy that the EU has won this award. I mean, you said in the introduction that eyebrows were raised, and that's true. And I think that's the case with every announcement of a Nobel Peace Prize. There's always some people who say, yes, this is a deserved winner, and there are other people who say they just don't understand what the Nobel people were thinking about. But if you look at what Alfred Nobel originally outlined in his will about the terms of the Nobel Peace Prize, he was looking for, he said a person, but we talk about organizations as well now, that have done the most work for fraternity between nations. The abolition or reduction of standing armies, well, the Europeans haven't abolished or reduced standing armies. They still have standing armies, but the European Union is not a military power. And then the building and promotion of peace congresses, well, it's a sort of an ongoing peace congress. The Europeans may be bickering right now, but at least they're bickering peacefully when it comes to dealing with the Eurozone crisis. Whereas for a long time they might have gone to war, or wars might have broken out between two or more countries. Really, the thought of European countries going to war now is really unthinkable. It's very difficult to think of a condition in which European countries would be pushed to the point where they feel that negotiation and discussion has broken down to the point where they would want to go to war. And I think that's the greatest achievement of the European Union, is that this is a part of the world which, as I said, had hundreds and hundreds of years of history of war and conflict, And now, since 1945, has had the longest uninterrupted spell of generalized peace in its history. And although you can't say absolutely for sure the European Union or its precursors must get all the credit for this, because the United States must get a great deal of credit for it as well, through NATO, for example, and there is no sort of one magic recipe or explanation for peace. If there was, presumably the world in general would be at peace. But the European Union, or the process of European integration, has played a huge role in encouraging European countries to work together, to integrate, to build networks, and to discuss their differences rather than fighting over their differences.
I want to come back to the question of the European Union's future role as opposed to NATO or the United Nations or other groups in just a minute. But first, a reminder, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the European Union today with Dr. Stefanos Katsikas, Director of Modern Greek Studies at the University of Illinois, and John McCormick, Professor of European Union Politics and Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of Political Science at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. We welcome you to the conversation as well at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. Dr. Katsikas, what is the future role of the European Union if it becomes a more political role? Is there a potential that it will sort of come to almost loggerheads with, and maybe that's not the right term, will move into territory that many might characterize as better addressed through NATO or through the United Nations or through some other entity? I mean, do we need so many different conglomerations of nations?
Well, the answer to that is it's early days right now. We don't know. I mean, and we don't know whether, you know, how the European Union is going to come out of this economic crisis right now. And on this issue, there are, I mean, the issue of the political union, there are conflicting views inside the European Union. There are members of the various political classes inside the Europe that they want to see the union developing into a kind of a federal, super federal state in competition with other Western institutions, including the and also states, including the United States of America, but there are others who believe that Europe, the future of the European Union, if it develops into a political union, it has to work closely with the other Atlantic and the Western institutions. I'm one of those. I think that one of the lessons, if I can put it in this way, that the recent crisis in Iraq has shown that Europe has not the luxury to work in competition with the United States, NATO, and other Western organizations. They have to work closer together. But as I said, going back, I mean, we are speculating now. We don't know how Europe will come out of this economic crisis, and we don't know if the project of Euro and the European Union will survive at the end of it. I hope, and we all hope, that it's going to survive, because, as I said, and I strongly believe, Europe has no alternative. The alternative will be going back to the period of economic competition, protectionism, rise of extreme and fascist parties, and possibly down the road another war on conflicts and violence, and this is going to pose stability to undermine stability in the region and also to the rest of the world. So, going back to what I said, I think that we don't know right now, but we hope that if Europe moves towards a political union, it has to work closely with other Western alliances and Western international institutions.
Professor McCormick, is the European Union's viability as a collective political strength, is that intrinsically linked to its economic viability? Meaning that you have to pull yourself out of the economic conditions that a lot of European Union nations are in, Greece in particular, which I want to get to later. And until you do that, you can't really see yourself, the EU can't see itself as a significant politically influential entity?
I think political viability is probably more important, the political will to work to keep the European Union together. I believe, I've always believed, that they will get past the Eurozone crisis simply because the Euro is too big to fail. If the Euro was to fail, even if there would be selective exits from the Euro, which I don't think are going to happen, not even in the case of Greece, but if the Euro was to fail in some fashion, I think it would undermine the political will for the European Union. It's very difficult to think of the European Union disappearing altogether. It would be reformulated in some fashion. I'm just talking worst-case scenario here. But right now there's a summit of European Union leaders underway in Brussels, literally, I think, as we speak. And one of the conjectures is that what is going to come out of this is a sort of a two-speed Europe, where you're going to have the Euro countries led by Germany and France forming a kind of a core of a fiscal union, and then you're going to have marginal countries, those that are not interested in the Euro, led by Britain and Sweden and Denmark, as sort of second-class citizens, if you like. So there may be this new arrangement that's set up. But if you look at all of the other areas the European Union has been involved in, it does go a long way beyond economics. One area in which they haven't made as much progress as they would have liked is foreign policy. Mm. Which raises a whole series of troubling questions. But they're going to get past this problem, but what comes out of this and when this new entity emerges, we'll have to wait and see.
Was this a politically motivated move on the part of the Nobel Committee? I mean, when they give out a peace prize, are they trying to send a specific statement about the European Union? You think?
Yes, I think if we look at the press release of the rationale behind the decision, I mean, it's stated clear that one of the main reasons why the Nobel Prize was awarded to the European Union is to honor this long-lasting peace and protection of human rights and the establishment of democracy in the region. I mean, it is clearly stated there.
And one thing I would say is that you're not allowed to know who nominates awardees for 50 years after the prize has been given. So it'll be a while before we know. But I've heard that the EU has been nominated several times before. The timing, I think, is coincidental. It's a little unfortunate. I mean, I agree with Dr. Katsika that there has to be some sort of political message that's being sent here. It's unfortunate that the award has been given right now when the EU seems to be in such trouble. But I suspect that nominations were made some time before these troubles arose. And I think we can't tie the current problems of the EU too much with the prize itself, because these problems will be fixed, and they're not the kind of problems that are going to cancel out the merits of the EU winning the Nobel Peace Prize in the first place.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests are Dr. Stefanos Katsikas, Director of Modern Greek Studies at the University of Illinois, and John McCormick, Professor of European Union Politics and Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of Political Science at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. We're discussing the European Union, and we welcome any questions or comments you have at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-9455. WILL. You can also email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. We will continue our conversation in just a couple of minutes, but first a reminder that WILL's fall fundraising campaign is continuing today. It's your opportunity to support the in-depth news and thoughtful analysis and conversations that you hear every day right here on WILL. We have a different phone number for you to call to do so, and that is 217-244-9455. That's 217-244-9455. Or if it's easier for you to remember, just call Big Will. Your contribution will help ensure the future of programs like Focus and will also allow us to continue to provide news and information that is factual, conversations that offer context and clarity about the issues and ideas that affect us all. You make this very important service available, not just for you, but for everyone throughout the region, and wherever else in the world that they may listen to this program from online. To tell us more about the importance of your contribution and where those dollars go, we are joined now by WILL station manager Bob Colquhoun. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Craig. I don't know if I want to be the station manager right now or guest on your show. I mean, it's wonderful to be on Focus. Yeah, you walk around in the community and people talk about how terrific this show has been for over the years, and the tradition continues. Diverse voices on Focus help listeners engage with ideas and become active participants in their communities. We have discussions on finance and healthcare, and the discussion today has been really intriguing. You know, you're educated. If you value from this service, give us a call. It's a wonderful program, 217-244-9455, or you can go right online to willpledge.org.
Bob, I know we have some important goals to meet throughout this campaign, including a dollar goal for today.
We do. Yeah. We're looking at $13,000 for today. I would love to get 10 callers during this show to show the support of this local program. And overall, we want to have 100 new friends throughout this whole drive. Now, we have many friends. So if you're renewing, you're our continued friend. We're talking about people who have not contributed before. So we want to get 100 new friends to our family here at WILL.
Well, it's terrific that you listen, and we're grateful for your engaged interest in a program like Focus. The idea here is to provide you with a thoughtful conversation, to provide some depth, some context about a variety of issues, and we really do sort of change up the subject matter every day.
Absolutely, and you lead that group, Craig, and you do very well. You think about not only the local coverage, you think about the regional coverage, the state coverage, the national coverage, the international coverage. We range from stuff that is produced here locally, NPR, PRI, and the BBC. Just think about that lineup. What other station really offers those type of listening opportunities to their audience? I don't think there's anyone else in town or around that will do what we do. Again, the number 217-244-9455.
Bob, I think it's important also to highlight how those sources of information, well, they come with a cost. We pay bills. We write out checks to each of those entities. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that works?
Well, each year we have costs, and when we, just like a budget, we go to the sources that produce these things. Each show has a cost. Sometimes we can negotiate a little bit on the cost, but each one is different. It's based on the listenership. It's based on how many hours it's produced, their staff. And, of course, as you know, Morning Edition and Fresh Air are higher on that end because they are daily programs. And so each program has a cost, and it's part of our budget. And the dollars that we raise from listeners like you help continue to sustain us to bring those programs to them day in, day out, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. 365 days a year.
And how many days is that in a decade? No, I'm not going to make you do that. We really do appreciate everyone who has supported this station. And if you have not yet become a friend of WILL, if you have not made your first of an annual financial commitment to this public radio station, please consider doing so right now at 217-244-9455. Bob, thanks very much. We'll check back with you in just a little while. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're talking about the European Union today, and I'm pleased to have joined into the conversation João Valle de Almeida, the European Union Ambassador to the United Nations. Ambassador, welcome to Focus.
Welcome. Good morning. How are you?
Glad to have you with us. We have been talking about the European Union, and we've been talking about its financial struggles. We've been talking about the EU receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, and I want to start with that. What's the significance in your mind of the EU receiving this year's Nobel Peace Prize, and why this year?
Well, first of all, let me say that we are extremely happy, extremely proud. We believe this is the recognition of everything we've done for the last 60 years to preserve peace in Europe and to build a continent-wide space of democracy, respect for human rights and freedom. And I think the Nobel Committee was absolutely right in awarding this prize, and again, we're very happy for it.
As I said, we've been talking about the financial struggles of one of the nations of the EU, Greece, where workers walked off the job again today to protest austerity policies as that nation tries to climb out from under a 5-year recession. Beyond financial support already committed under certain conditions, what role can and should the European Union play in seeing Greece's economy specifically rebounds?
Well, we are actively supporting Greece, as we are supporting all the other member states that are going through a difficult period. You should remember that these are aftershocks of the financial crisis of 2008. This crisis has had a particular impact in countries which are more vulnerable in the European Union, Greece being one of them. But there is a full commitment by the other members, by the European institutions, by the European Union as a whole, to support and help these countries overcome these difficult times. And this is part of our project, also again recognized by the Nobel Committee, the possibility and the capacity of these countries and the willingness to work together to solve their problems, not through war or through confrontation, but through dialogue, consensus, and common solutions.
As the EU ambassador to the U.S., what changes, if any, would you like to see in U.S. economic or diplomatic policy that can impact the nations of the European Union?
Well, I think this crisis has confirmed that in a globalized economy, we are in this together. That is, what happens here has an impact in Europe and vice versa. So what we would like to see in the U.S. is, of course, the U.S. economy getting back to solid growth, the U.S. dealing with, of course, the problems that we also have in Europe, basically the deficit and debt, and also the U.S. economy to be more competitive in a very competitive world economy. So we have similar problems across on both sides of the Atlantic. My wish is that we work more and more together to address those issues, also to deal with the emerging economies, which are our partners, but also competitors. And I believe because we share common values, because we fundamentally have the same strategic interests, U.S. and EU, we can and we should work even better than we are working today. And that's my wish for the future.
Is that strategic effort best dealt with through diplomacy between states, or is it best dealt with through private industry from one nation to another?
Both. I think there's a role for diplomacy, there's a role for government, as much as there is a role for business and other entities of the civil society, non-governmental organizations, and beyond that. I think there's place for everyone in this effort to deal with a world which is more unpredictable than the one we used to know at the time of the Cold War, new threats, new challenges, most of them global. No single country can deal with them alone. But if we cooperate, and particularly if we cooperate across the Atlantic, I think we have better chances of achieving our goals.
And yet each nation has its own policies and laws regarding how financial transactions take place, how banks operate. They have their own sets of regulations. Does that complicate the process of trying to shepherd collective economic vitality between both the U.S. and Europe?
We are a union of nation states, and we basically want to keep it that way. We respect diversity, we respect the individual identity of each nation in Europe. But at the same time, in the last 60 years, we have shared more and more sovereignty with the others. More and more decisions are taken collectively, and more decisions are taken at the European level. And this is the result of our clear belief that there are things that we can do better at European level than national level. But a few powers, important powers still, are reserved to nation states, to each member state. We have a good articulation between the European and the national level. I don't think this is a problem. But it requires discussions, negotiations, and dialogue. And this is what the European Union is about, and this is what the Nobel Committee has recognized with this great award.
But what about between the EU and other nations, including the United States, where there are different policies and regulations?
Yeah, I mean, there are less and less. There is an effort of convergence on regulatory issues, on trade, on economic. So I'm very much hopeful that we can proceed on this path, because I believe this is the progress we need if we want to address the real problems of our economies. In a globalized economy, we cannot simply isolate ourselves if we want to reap the benefits of the scale of the global market.
I know you're tied on time. Very quickly, finally, can you suggest maybe one specific way the U.S. and the European Union can most effectively work together to promote both peace and prosperity in the world?
Well, I think the area of the Mediterranean, the wider Middle East, remains a very sensitive area. I think we can do a lot together as far as the Middle East peace process is concerned. We can do a lot together to help the countries in that region that are looking for freedom and democracy. I think it's a big challenge, but a great opportunity also to promote our values in that part of the world, with full respect for the wish of the populations, but at the same time, providing them the assistance and the support that they deserve, so that we, help achieve our goals in that region, which is basically to increase prosperity, and through prosperity, the stability and security for ourselves as well.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for your time.
Nice talking to you. Thank you very much.
All right. That's Joao Valle de Almeida, the European Union Ambassador to the United States. You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and remaining with us for the remainder of the hour is Dr. Stefanos Katsikas, Director of Modern Greek Studies at the University of Illinois, and John McCormick, Professor of European Union Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. We're talking about the European Union, and we welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Dr. Katsikas, first, just immediate reactions to what you heard from the ambassador. Among the quotes that stuck out to me, he said, in a globalized economy, we are in this together. And then he also stressed the idea that maybe the biggest challenge facing the EU and the United States is what's happening in the Middle East. And that sort of underscores what you were saying earlier.
Yes, that's true. And this is also something that my fellow citizens in Greece have to realize in relation to this crisis, because there are voices inside the country that Greece should opt out of the euro and should leave the euro. I think we have to realize that we, in a globalized world, Greece has not the luxury not to cooperate with the European partners and the Eurozone and the European Union, because the alternative would be being at the margins of the European Union and threatening stability in the Balkan region and southeastern Europe in an already destabilizing Middle East.
Professor McCormick, what's your reaction to what you heard from the ambassador?
Well, he's an ambassador, so he's very diplomatic. I'm less optimistic about the possibilities of the transatlantic relationship. I think it is essential that the United States and the Europeans work together. They can bring particular skills to the discussion. I saw a joke somewhere that the Americans do the cooking, the Europeans do the washing up. Hmm. Meaning the United States has the military capacity, also has the economic capacity as well. But ultimately, what really defines American power in the world is military power. The Europeans don't really have it. They have a large national militaries, but they don't have a combined military, and they have a half-formed joint security policy. But I think the Europeans and the Americans look at the world in different ways, and that's what worries me a little bit. I mean, we have the same belief in democracy and free markets and human rights and so forth, but I think we see enough divisions between the Americans and Europeans that I do wonder sometimes. I think on the Middle East, and particularly on the question of Israel, the two sides differ, and I just don't know how the two sides are going to come together in such a way as to bring the right kind of answers to bear on what is clearly the most dangerous part of the world at the moment, and has been for quite some time.
Do you think those attitudes have shifted at all, though, say in the last 20 years or so?
They've shifted in the sense that I think that the differences between the Americans and the Europeans have become more obvious. During the Cold War, they were more or less on the same side. The Western Europeans really had to go along with the Americans publicly. Privately, they would disagree. I mean, there were disagreements between the two sides, but the Europeans really didn't have much negotiating ground. Now, since the end of the Cold War, the removal of the Soviet threat was the one thing that really kept the Americans and the Western Europeans very much on the same, reading off the same script. And I think we now see the differences of it being emerging. And I think, you know, it's symbolized most obviously by the fact that France and Germany were openly opposed to the invasion of Iraq. I think that was a really dramatic change in direction. I think at the end of the day, though, they will always try to find ways to work together. I'm just not convinced that they will always be themselves convinced that they are, in fact, moving in the same direction.
Dr. Katsikas, does that example, France and Germany and their opposition to the war in Iraq, does that demonstrate the sort of challenge that the European Union itself faces if it wants to move towards what you keep referring to as sort of a being more of a political entity? There isn't necessarily a unified political opinion from all of Europe on any number of issues.
Well, there is no unified political opinion in any country of the world, including the United States, for example. I mean, if you ask, for instance, the American political class what direction they want to see the American foreign policy to take, you'll find different opinions inside the Republicans, inside the Democrats, between the Republicans and the Democrats. So you'll find different opinions and conflicting opinions, of course. And as I said earlier, inside the European Union, there are two, if I can put it in a general and if not in a simplistic way, schools of thought. On the one hand, there are members of the political class across different European countries who want to see Europe develop in a kind of political union in competition with the states and other, you know, Western international institutions, and others who want to see this work together. And I think that despite the failings that the European Union foreign policy we have witnessed in the past couple of years, for instance, in the Balkans, Europe failed in the 1990s to prevent a war, let's say, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, or, you know, to prevent the dissolution of Yugoslavia. And one can mention many other cases like that. In the long term, We have seen that the European Union is moving towards a closer cooperation in the field of foreign policy. In the field of defense, we haven't seen that much progress, but still, I mean, there are some steps taken to this, positive steps to this direction as well. So we don't have what we want at this stage, but we don't know what is going to happen in the future, and we shouldn't be surprised if in a couple of years, for instance, we see the European Union coming out with a more unified foreign policy or a unified defense policy, and having a, you know, a more unanimous taking decisions in foreign policy issues in the Middle East, in other areas in Africa, and so on.
Professor McCormick, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking to myself and Dr. Katsikas, who, patently, we're both pretty pro-European, I think. We have to bear in mind that there's a lot of anti-Europeans out there as well. They're called Eurosceptics. And Euroscepticism, which comes in many different shades and forms, has been growing since the 1990s, since the EEC became the European Union. And there's a lot of backlash now against the troubles of the euro, which is sort of feeding into this Euroscepticism. So you have mainstream political parties who have Eurosceptic wings within them, and then you have new political parties, right-wing anti-immigrant tend to be those sort of political parties, who also tend to be anti-European. And this Euroscepticism or reaction to Europe is growing, and this is bringing a completely new element into the discussion about where Europe is headed.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests today are Dr. Stefanos Katsikas, Director of Modern Greek Studies at the University of Illinois, and John McCormick, Professor of European Union Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. We're talking about the European Union. Last week, the EU was awarded this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Many of us tend to define the EU as an economic partnership of sovereign states, but there is much more to it, and we're exploring what was behind the decision to award the EU the Nobel Peace Prize. We've been discussing that, also talking about some of the challenges facing the European Union. and in particular, some of the nations within it, like Greece, where workers walked off the job today for the second time in 3 weeks to protest austerity measures put in place, like wage and pension cuts, all designed to address the country's fiscal crisis. We'll talk some more about Greece in just a little bit, but we welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or will-talk@illinois.edu. And let's go to Paul in Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Yeah, a few years ago, there was this concept of the democratic deficit and the idea whether the Bolkestein model, I believe is the guy's name, sort of, it's analogous to globalization. Is globalization going to be corporate or is it going to be a democratic globalization? And it's the Council of Europe versus the European Parliament to some extent. It just seems to me that you can say you're pro-Europe, but it doesn't tell you what kind of Europe you're pro. And the idea that the Europeans are, you know, generally in favor of free trade, I mean, they have a very much of a different definition of what that means and even its value. The other thing, I had two points I wanted to bring up, and that would probably cover the end of the show, but there is this idea of the regionalism in Europe as well. Catalans and the Scottish are both talking about seceding from their current nation state, and I would presume that they would still see themselves as European, and I'm just wondering what you think about in terms of what the role of the broader EU is going to be vis-a-vis that kind of, I remember a while back vis-a-vis the Irish question, and the idea was that, well, if we integrate Ireland, it'll be less consequential that Northern Ireland is a polity under the UK if everyone is more integrated, and it seemed to work to some extent. But,
all right, I'm just going to stop you there, Paul, because I want to give our guests a chance to respond. Dr. Katsikas, in some ways, it sounds like maybe he's getting into issues of regional identity as much as anything else. Is there a concern about that sort of identification becoming more muddied if you have everybody sort of under one umbrella?
Well, I think that, and as the ambassador said before, I mean, this is the thing with the European Union, that it allows different expressions and different identities to be accommodated inside, you know, a political union. And there is I can't see anything wrong about that. I mean, as long as there are not conflicts that, you know, threaten the stability of a region or the European continent. But why don't we look at, for instance, the positive effects of the European enlargement and the European integration in areas like Eastern Europe and the Balkans? Could anybody imagine what the consequences would be in that region after the dissolution of the Soviet bloc if the European Union didn't have a vision of integrating those regions into the EU? We would have seen perhaps in the Balkans and in Caucasus and in other regions prolonged conflicts there. So there is diversity, of course, and we may see more diversity, regional diversity in the future, having, you know, the Scots, for instance. There is an ongoing discussion in the United Kingdom wanting, you know, to claim independence and so on. As long as all these regions are part of the European Union, they are accommodated inside, and all these problems are being solved in a peaceful way, I don't see any problem with that.
Professor McCormick, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would tend to agree. One of the things that you have to understand about Europe is that most Europeans have long had two kinds of identity. One is a national identity and one is a state identity. So Catalans feel Catalan and they also feel Spanish. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, we have a third kind of identity which has been added, which is European. So Europeans now have these three different things to choose from. And what tends to be happening over time is that the European Union has grown in significance. Nations have also grown in significance, and the state is getting squeezed out in the middle. And, you know, over the long sweep of history, that may not be such a bad thing as it may at first sound, because if you look at the history of states, they're the ones that tend to go to war with each other. Now, nations also do tend to go to war with each other, too, but the kind of nationalism you're seeing in Europe, except for the right-wing nationalism, the anti-immigrant nationalism, the rest of it is more benign, sort of cultural nationalism. So the Scots want some more self-determination. They don't want to go to war over it. They're going to have a referendum. And I think that shows the kind of the trends that are taking place there. But you have these multiple different identities, and you have to think about how they're all changing over time.
Let's take another call. We have Tony on the line from Champaign. Hi, Tony.
Yeah, we do quantitative easing here in the United States, and I understand that in the EU, which I think is a wonderful development, by the way, is they're kind of toying with the idea as well, but it just points to my ignorance about how the monetary system in the EU right now, could someone give a brief history of how it was developed? And perhaps whose approach to a monetary system was most influential? And I'd like to hang up and...
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Professor McCormick?
Yeah, briefly, you know, one of the core goals of European integration has always been the creation of a European single market, which means bringing down the barriers to the movement of people, money, goods, and services, the four freedoms, and that's what they've been working on since 1958. But right from the beginning, it was understood that you couldn't really have a single market without a single currency. So they started working on it way back in the 1960s when they were talking about exchange rate stability. And they experimented with several different options, a couple of which collapsed in flames. And then eventually, mid-1990s, they came up with this plan for what is now the euro. And they laid down various conditions that countries would have to meet in order to join the euro. And then several countries went off and ignored most of those conditions, including Germany, which was the leader in the euro project and was most concerned about these conditions, for example, budget deficits being controlled and inflation being controlled and so forth. Germany was very concerned about those conditions being met, and then went off and kind of ignored those conditions, and then we have the problems that we have today. So that's sort of the history of European monetary integration in about 55 seconds.
All right. And before we wrap up, Dr. Katsikas, I did want to talk a little bit about Greece. And as I mentioned, Greek workers from the country's two largest labor unions walked off the job today. It's the second time they've done this in 3 weeks. The nation has to make at least 11.5 billion euros worth of cuts before they receive the next chunk of money, I guess, in this 130 billion euro bailout from the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the IMF. What will it take to pull Greece out of what is now a five-year recession? Is there an easy answer, or is this a long and difficult slog like every economy?
Yeah, let me also repeat before I answer your question what the ambassador told before. I mean, Greece perhaps is the weakest link, if to put it in this way, in the European Union, but it's not the only problem. There are also other countries, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, down the road, potentially France, and at the end of the road, perhaps, you know, if, you know, Germany. So Greece is, you know, has a serious problem, but it's not the only problem right now in Europe. Well, to go out of the crisis, Greece has no alternative but to work closely with the European community and the European partners there. It has to take tough decisions and tough measures which have been postponed for years there. I mean, to minimize the public sector, for example, to make the necessary structural reforms and adjustments in the economy. Otherwise, the alternative will be being on its own, not only in Europe, but also in the international system. And this is going to be dangerous for the stability of the country and the region around it.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you, Dr. Stefanos Katsikas, Director of Modern Greek Studies at the University of Illinois. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And John McCormick's Professor of European Union Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Professor McCormick, thank you for talking with us today as well.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Support comes from the Klein Center for Democracy on the U of I campus with the 2012 Klein Symposium keynote address, Dealing with Debt and Deficits in a Dysfunctional Political Environment, by Dr. Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, Monday, October 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center Ballroom. Details at kleincenter.illinois.edu.
A program like Focus is only possible because of individuals just like you who become annual contributors to WILL. We provide in-depth news and information, thoughtful conversations, contextual analysis, but annual donors provide the funds that make it all possible. We simply can't do this without you. So I hope you will go to the phone and make a contribution in support of WILL at 217-244-9455. And I welcome back in Bob Colquhoun.
Hey, it's great to be here. What a show, Craig. International flavor all the way through. Long-distance guest, an out-of-state guest, an ambassador, and someone in the studio with us, Stefan. Excellent, excellent show.
Well, thank
you. And this is what you deliver day in and day out on WILL. If you've enjoyed this, we need to hear from you folks. We'd like to hear from at least 10 people during this break. The phone number, 217-244-9455. You know, we believe that this community is a better place if people hear all sides of the story. On Focus, you connect to the decision makers and the opinion shapers. We believe that the dollars we invest to keep you connected is money we spend well. Please take this moment of support to this public radio station, WILL, who has kept our audience satisfied for over 90 years.
That's saying something, isn't it?
It is.
That's quite a legacy.
That number, 217-244-9455. Or if you want to, feel comfortable donating online, willpledge.org.
We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, or American Express. Or if you'd prefer to have us mail you an invoice, we'd be happy to have you pay by check. Whatever's easiest for you, and in terms of the amount that you give, well, I mean, it's up to you. Whatever seems appropriate for your budget. But if a dollar a day is within your budget, please consider doing that. If $1,000 is appropriate, consider that. If $52, a dollar a week is appropriate, consider that. 217-244-9455 or online at willpledge.org. Bob, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, too.
On tomorrow's show, we will open up the phone lines and welcome your suggestions for future topics right here on Focus. We'll also take the opportunity to describe some of the efforts behind the scenes here at WILL to maintain this show and this great service and review the characteristics we've identified that we believe make up the ideal Focus topic, and that's on tomorrow's program. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.